Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters.
Hello, at 2 p.m. on July 9th, 1860, a mob attacked the Christian quarter of Damascus. For over a week, shops, churches, houses, and monasteries were attacked, looted, and burned. Men were killed, women raped and abducted, children taken from their families. Some 5,000 Christians were ultimately killed, about half of them refugees who had fled to the city from Mount Lebanon during an earlier outbreak of violence there. The others were all native Damascenes, about 15% of the Christian population of Damascus. These 8 days of terror became known as the Damascus Events. In his new book, my guest Eugene Rogan describes the external and internal pressures which led to the Damascus Events, the immediate precipitation of those events, the 8 days of violence in tick-tock detail, how the violence was ended, and finally how the Christian population was reintegrated into the Damascus community. Eugene Rogan is professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Oxford, where he is also the director of the Middle East Center at St. Anthony College, Oxford. Author of numerous books, his most recent is The Damascus Events, The 1860 Massacre, and The Making of the Middle East. Eugene Rogan, welcome to Historically Thinking.
Al, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So, as we were discussing before I began recording, one of the things that was delightful in writing the book, and it's delightful for the reader, is the strong protagonists. And I suggested to you that perhaps the strongest protagonist is the place itself, which you bring vividly to, so that I can certainly see it. I feel sometimes at times I can almost touch it and smell it. So let's talk about Damascus in 1860, which in the Near East, throughout Arabia, was a legendary place.
Damascus is one of the most ancient cities on the face of the planet. It's remarkable that even at the time of the drafting of the Hebrew Bible, Damascus was an old city. When Saul gets his conversion on the road to Damascus, it's a place that's already fabled. So by the time we get to the 19th century, just the very depth of the roots of Damascus going back through the history of the ancient Near East right through the Islamic empires left not just readers today impressed by the antiquity of the city, but I think it's what made Damascenes at that time so very proud of their city. They were unbearably arrogant about the beauty of their city and the preeminence of Damascus among all the towns of the Arab world. People from Aleppo found them unbearable, and I imagine most others did as well. But they were really fiercely proud of this cultured and historical city they called home.
So what made Damascus different than, not just its antiquity, what made Damascus unique in Syria, in Palestine, in Arabia?
We'll start with the actual geographical location of Damascus. Damascus is, in a sense, a miracle that defies geography, because you have a flourishing, verdant city on the very edge of the Syrian desert. Leave the course of the Barada River, which feeds the city, and you're surrounded by dust. But wherever the waters of the Barada and the Fiji Springs reach the city, it sparkled with water and with life. And so people arrive in the city and describe it as a kind of emerald against the desert background. And the geographical beauty of it, with its verdant gardens, fruit trees, shade trees, water gardens. And everyone describes coming into the city and how even when they go into people's homes, that you had the constant tinkling of water running through channels, through the middle of houses, into fountains and courtyards. So what really made Damascus stand out in its setting, what made it seem like a little patch of paradise in the otherwise very dry Syrian desert landscape, was the miracle of water. And I guess that is why Damascus has been so continuously inhabited. Wherever in the Middle East you found reliable water, there people built their cities.
So I thought of some points, water on the edge of the desert. It's like California. It's it has the same sort of, you know, mystical golden glow of two of this improbable combination leading to wealth. And it's also at the end of the caravan route from Iraq, right? I mean, it's the route from up from Arabia and from Mecca. So it's a seaport in a way. It's a crossroads.
It is. But of course, that port was frequented by the ships of the desert. And so you have these wonderful descriptions of mid-19th century Damascus as the big caravans arrive from Baghdad or from Mecca and Medina. 3,000, 4,000 camels long. And of course, it wasn't economically sensible to send cheap goods by camel caravan. You know, you weren't going to send grain that way. You sent the most luxuriant spices. You sent silk and gold and silver. You sent frankincense and myrrh. You know, it was a luxury trade. So when the caravans arrived, it set off a sort of feeding frenzy among the merchants of Damascus to try and get in and bid on the valuable wares that then made the markets of Damascus just sparkle. So all the visitors who went through Damascus in the 19th century describe markets that seemed to come out of 1001 Nights with just rich, locally manufactured goods and then imported goods from India, from Persia, from Baghdad, from Southeast Asia, from East Africa, all channeling through the markets of Damascus and all through these wonderful caravans across the deserts that turned Damascus into a desert-facing port as opposed to its neighboring city, Beirut, very much a Mediterranean-facing port.
Let's talk about another protagonist, an extraordinary man who is at various times a businessman, a doctor, always a scholar, and also a representative of the Republic of the United States of America.
His name is Mikhail Mishakov. And by local accounts, he was widely recognized as the most intelligent man in all of Syria. He was, as you say, a jack of many trades, and he taught them all to himself. And due to his connections to the British consulate in Damascus, as well as to the American Protestant missionaries who were working in Greater Syria, he converted to Protestantism, was very close to the Anglophone world, though he himself spoke no English. And when the Americans decided that to advance their own trade interests in Damascus and its neighborhood, they needed their own consular agent in that city, he was the natural choice for the job. It was his records that really were the starting point for me in writing this book.
So how can we tell a little bit more about him? I'm curious about how... I think listeners will be curious about how he came to all these trades, at least the let's go through the businessman doctor sort of thing, because how he became, it is extraordinary how he's recognized for his abilities in something in all these areas where he's self-taught.
But it's clear that from a young age, young Mikhail was an autodidact. And he was born in the village of Rishmaya in Mount Lebanon in what is now the highlands of the Republic of Lebanon. Rishmaya did not have a school. The school system was not particularly extensive in Mount Lebanon at that time. So a curious young man had to turn to either religious authorities or else visitors to try and lay hold of books. And Mishaka was curious about astronomy. He wanted to know about science. He wanted to know about pretty much everything under the sun. He had a well-traveled uncle who always traveled with a bag of books, and took him back to the Egyptian Delta town of Damietta, where his uncle had a thriving business, and gave young Mikhail his first internship as a businessman.
And so this is we're bringing the whole Lebanese diaspora network into this too. He goes back to Egypt.
Absolutely. And I think an ambitious young man found that their opportunities were fairly limited in the highlands of Lebanon. You needed to get out in the world. And so, mm-hmm. you know, this was a different age, but you could get pretty much between Damietta and Mount Lebanon pretty easily by horse or camel, a few days' ride. And he put in a few years, learned the trade of import and export, took that back to Mount Lebanon with him, where he showed himself clever with numbers, good at bookkeeping, and was soon being drawn into the service of the ruling princes of Mount Lebanon, of the Shihabi family. And in this way, he was drawn into his second trade. The princes of Mount Lebanon recognized he was bright, but he also didn't understand much of the way that politics worked. And so there, I think, the Machiavellian side of the courts of Mount Lebanon served to give him an education. His father, too, had served in the courts, so he was familiar, and served the Shihabi family well. They took him to one of the towns in the southern reaches of Lebanon, on the border with Syria, where he served as a clerk to one of the Shihabi princes and was given control over large estates. And then he entered his second profession as a sort of gentleman farmer, with land stretching down to the Galilee and modern Israel, Palestine. And that was shattered when in the 1830s, the neighboring province of Egypt, headed by a very ambitious governor named Mehmed Ali Pasha, embarked on an invasion of Greater Syria to add those lands to the areas under his control at the expense of his sovereign, the Ottoman Sultan. And for most of the 1830s, Syria passes under Egyptian rule. And at that time, Mishaka has moved from Mount Lebanon to Damascus and is very much drawn into the world of Damascus under Egyptian occupation, where he deepens his knowledge of medicine. He becomes the chief medical officer in Damascus. He is taken under the wing of the famous French medical doctor and educator, Clote Bey, and was ultimately given his diploma as an MD through the Kasrilaini Hospital in Cairo in the 1840s. So, you know, we just see this man of endless intellectual curiosity, clear ability, drawing on every opportunity to broaden his knowledge. And as the world around him underwent unprecedented seismic change, adapting to changing times by changing professions.
Now, he was originally, from birth, a Maronite Christian. Is that correct?
He was actually from the Greek Catholic Church.
The Greek Catholic Church, because there are varieties of Christian faiths which are somehow trapped still in like the First or Second Crusade, or they're like Byzantine Greeks who then made some peace with Latin princes or didn't, and all this variegation comes from that sort of instance.
It seems. And there are, you know, 10 or 12 different denominations of Christianity spread across Greater Syria as a result. So the Greek Catholics are an offshoot of the Greek Orthodox Church, which was, if you like, the dominant denomination in the Ottoman Empire. After all, the Ottomans conquered the Byzantine Empire, which was a Greek Orthodox-led empire. But the Greek Catholics came to accept the authority of the Pope in the Vatican, and so became, as it were, a splinter of the Greek Orthodox Church, recognizing the Pope, but keeping a lot of the Greek rite. That was the church into which Mikhail Mishaka was born. But in the course of his travels and learning, he came to question the veracity of the church's teachings. He began to accuse the priests of ignorance, of promoting thoughts not because they were God's word so much as man's word, and maybe designed to enhance the authority of the clergy at the expense of their flock. And Mishaka just didn't want to be a sheep in a flock. When he began to challenge things, he reached out to the Christian missionaries, the American Presbyterian missionaries, who preached a very iconoclastic, austere Protestant vision of Christianity, which actually provided Mishaka with just the kind of faith community that he had been looking for, stripped of all of its kind of myths and accretions. He thought this was really the purest, truest rendition of Jesus's word. So Mishaka wasn't an atheist, but he had his problems with the religion that he was born into. But when he signed on to Protestant Christianity and declared to his church that he was leaving, the patriarch of the Greek Catholic Church went after him with both barrels, basically declaring him an apostate and denouncing him before all. And they launched a kind of battle of the Titans, where every denunciation by the patriarch was met by a new tract by Mishaka in defense of his views and condemning those of his birth faith. And the American missionaries were quick to publish these tracts by Mishaka as the best propaganda they'd been given in the Arabic language. And I think Mishaka wound up producing 6 or 8 tracts against Monsignor, the Archbishop Maximilius Mazlum, to really debate the basis of his Christian faith. So
now,
a challenging exchange between two really brilliant intellects.
Now, apostate he might be, but does he still maintain his family and informational networks in Mount Lebanon for the remainder of his life?
Well, in a sense, since about 1834, Mishaka had made Damascus his home. Mm-hmm. And at the time of his conversion, he was under attack from the patriarch in Damascus. But, you know, he was at this time a mature man. He was, approaching 50. And he was confident of his place in society and of his networks. He was an Ottoman Christian notable with a respected profession. And I think that he felt confident he could weather the storm. He certainly showed no shyness in engaging in a polemic with the patriarch of his church, and he never backed down. He simply was a very dogmatic man, and when he made up his mind, he stuck to his guns.
And as you had said earlier, his Protestant conversion makes him and his connections to American Presbyterians makes him a very attractive as an. His influence, his connections, his sort of intellectual superiority within the Damascus community makes him a very attractive as a representative of the United States. We should explain, we should talk now about the story with which you begin the book, which, as I said to you prior, is the story that every historian dreams of happening to himself. Not long ago, some social psychologists were like listening to me talk about the archives, and they were sort of patting me on the head and saying, one of them said, I love it when the way that you historians talk about the archives. They said, kind of, they're there. It also reminded me of my wife when I come back from the archives sometimes with my eyes shining and kind of babbling and shaking like I've just drunk too much caffeine. My wife will say, we should really get you in the archives every month. And I was like, reading your story gave me that same experience. So could you tell how you found Mishaka's – well, go ahead. How you found the sort of the written reports of Mihaly Mishaka in the National Archives in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, Al, you're a historian. You understand what the archive means to us in our trade. It's a huge part of the fun in what we do is the treasure hunt. And you go into an archive – hoping to find something really amazing that no one else has clapped eyes on before. And it's a document here or a sentence there. But I was in for a very special treat back in January of 1989 when, as a humble doctoral student, I had gone to the American Archives to consult the records from the American consulates in Damascus and Jerusalem. My own research was actually on Transjordan, which was a kind of frontier area to the south of Damascus that had not really been much studied. And if you wanted to find reports on that region, then the two vantage points were from Damascus, which was the Ottoman administrative center under which Transjordan fell, or else Jerusalem to the west of Transjordan, which overlooked the region. And in my research, I learned that our first consular agent in Damascus, our first vice consul, was actually this very well-known Syrian intellectual named Mihail Mishaka. Well-known to me because just before then, the Harvard scholar Wheeler Thaxton had just brought out a translation of Mishaka's history. The history in Arabic was entitled A Response to the Suggestion of the Loved Ones. It rhymes in Arabic, Al-Jawab al-Iqtirah al-Ahbab. But whether by Thaxton's doing or his publishers, it came out in English under the much more salacious title of Murder, Mayhem, Pillage, and Plunder, A History of Syria and Lebanon in the 18th and 19th Century. So I knew Mishaka was one of the most important historical writers of my period. And I was dying to know what his reports looked like. So as I go to the archives in January 1989, I call up the first five volumes of reports from Damascus starting in 1859. And the archivists come back with my trolley, but the volumes they brought me start with volume 4. And I asked what happened to volumes 1 through 3, and they said the archivists couldn't find them. I asked if someone else had checked them out. They said, no, the Damascus volumes weren't often consulted. They suggested I try again, and I did, and I got the same result. So the person at the desk said, look, why don't you make an appointment to actually go into the stacks with one of the archivists? And I would have done that anyway. Just to get look behind the scenes, right? Have you done that?
Yeah, exactly.
Been in there?
In the National Archive? Never. I thought you got shot if you tried, if you even asked.
Absolutely. So to get admitted to the inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies, was in itself so amazing. And, you know, at this point, the archives were still in downtown D.C. They hadn't yet moved to College Park, Maryland, where they are held now. So, you know, that building with its neoclassical architecture is so impressive. But when you go inside the stacks, it's literally miles of shelves with these leather-bound volumes with, you know, Rio de Janeiro, with Rome, with Bangkok, with dates going back to the 1700s, all in gilt on leather spines. Amazing space. I was taken to the bay with the records from Damascus, and everything looked in perfectly good order. And I, accompanied by the archivist, went from top to bottom to see if something had been misshelved. I didn't want to waste the archivist's time anymore. And I was just about to give up my search and leave when I saw on one lower shelf at the far end, these three little notebooks. And I took the first one down. And it was clearly an old, I would have said local Damascene notebook, with a paper label glued on the front cover, written in hand, and it said in Arabic, Register of the Correspondence from the American Vice Consulate in Damascus, 1859 to 1865. And I knew I had found the first three volumes. But the joy of this was they had been misshelved. They probably had not been consulted by anyone since they were first repatriated from Damascus, which meant that I was holding in my hands archival material by one of the most famous writers of 19th century Syria that no scholar before me had ever laid hold on. And I genuinely had the shakes as I made my way back to the reading room and began to flip through the pages that had been very lovingly handwritten by my hero, Mikhail Mishaka, capturing the events leading up to the Damascus massacre and its aftermath. I was holding the most important new source on one of the most important historical events in 19th century Syrian history. Imagine that.
And what I also love is who would look for handwritten Arabic manuscripts in the National Archives in D.C.? Who else? You were probably the first person in decades that had gone in there that was able to read. No wonder why they had been misplaced.
Well,
you were able to read them.
Again, you'll find that there's a lot of excellent material from provincial cities across Greater Syria in Arabic because it was standard practice. The United States was a small and not particularly rich republic in 1859, and they could only afford to send so many foreign service officers to posts in faraway Eastern Mediterranean cities. So the Americans hired a lot of locals in places like Latakia or Nablus or Sidon or Tyre. And in that way, the reports coming back in Arabic would be translated by a translation bureau for the consul's benefit, an American citizen based in Beirut. But there's a lot of great material for the Arabic reader from small towns in Syria right through the 19th century.
So the, because I was curious about this process, Mishaka is writing his reports in Arabic. They go to the consulate in Beirut. They're translated by someone in the consulate, I guess for the attention of the ambassador in Istanbul, as well as for the Secretary of State. And then the original and the translation are sent to Washington.
Ultimately, they are repatriated at the end of the day. But okay. A lot of the local records, and these are consular records as opposed to the diplomatic dispatches. So the standard chain of command would be from the vice consul to their consul in Beirut. And then the consul in Beirut would take whatever information from his network and draft that into his reports to the ambassador in Constantinople. And then the ambassador in Constantinople would communicate with the Secretary of State. It would be very seldom would material go directly from Damascus to Washington.
So let's I should say before we move on, I mean, the United States consuls, it's actually a kind of fascinating history in an era in which we've kind of forgotten about diplomatic history. And in the show notes, I'll link to the Consolation Prize, which is a podcast from R2 Studios at George Mason, in which they've been going through some of the histories of consuls around the world in the 19th century, maybe the 20th, I think, which include characters like, of all people, John Singleton Mosby, Confederate hero turned Republican consul general to Hong Kong. So there's a lot of interesting people that ended up as consuls, both local and American, and they are a fantastic window into the 19th century world. To overuse a metaphor or simile, you make it clear that Damascus, Syria, Mount Lebanon, that region, is a sort of pressure cooker in 1860. There are lots of things that are slowly expanding it and putting it under extreme duress. And there are also a lot of things that are kind of assaulting it from without, influences, cultural, social, political, from without. So it's getting it from both sides. Yeah. You've mentioned the Egyptian occupation. That's sort of maybe one. Could you mention some other? Let's talk about trade. We've already alluded to the ships of the desert, the luxury goods coming from Baghdad, from Arabia. What does Damascus depend on in terms of its internal industry or production other than fruit? How is that under threat by this new era of 19th century trade?
Damascus had a very extensive artisanal manufacturing industry in its own right. So the Damascenes were celebrated across the Ottoman world for their fabrics, which would be blends of wool, silk, and cotton in very elaborate patterns that are captured in lots of Orientalist paintings of just the rich, gorgeous fabrics within from which native dress was made. And in addition to that, you had obviously Damascene steel has always been very celebrated. 19th century visitors tended to talk down the quality of steel at that age, not quite as good as it had been in the 12th, 13th, 14th century. But nonetheless, the steel makers, the sword makers were an active community, as were metal workers in general. Lots of brass, copper, metal work being done. A lot of very famous wooden inlay work, particularly with mother of pearl, highly decorative for furniture, for things like the clogs that people wore in the bathhouses. So you had a whole range of these trades and professions that were particular to Damascus. And then, of course, we've already talked about the luxury goods that came both from the Baghdad caravans as well as those coming from Mecca and Medina that were to stock the markets of Damascus with luxury goods from faraway places. Against all of that, starting in the 1830s and 40s, you have a growing invasion of industrial products coming from Germany, France, Britain, Italy, reaching the Eastern Mediterranean in growing numbers. And their speed is accelerating as sailing gives way to steam shipping in the 1840s. Steamships were originally not as reliable. They were smaller. But that technology evolved very quickly so that by the 1840s, 1850s, we're finding very reliable, very fast steamships coming to the Eastern Mediterranean to dump fabrics that are now going head-to-head with the production of Damascene looms, often cheaper, because it costs so much less to produce machine-made fabrics than it did handmade fabrics. And to make matters even worse, all these ships don't want to return from Beirut and other eastern ports with empty holds. They need to be making money both directions. But what they want to take back to European markets are raw materials. So they're trying to collect as much cotton, as much wool, as much grain to fill their holds as they can. But in the process, they're driving up the cost of primary products for all the local producers who suddenly find competition for locally sourced wool or cotton or silk. That is putting them under what you might call a kind of scissors crisis, where the price for their own goods are being pushed down by competition with industrial goods coming from Europe, and the price of their primary products are going up, making their production costs higher and higher.
And the margins are squeezing and squeezing and squeezing and cutting.
It just puts the local producers under tremendous pressure. But who are the beneficiaries of this trade? All these European merchant houses hire local Christians to serve as their agents. And local Christians are gaining materially from the trade developments that are really beginning to hurt the Muslim merchants. So one community's gain is at another community's disadvantage. And that is immediately beginning to set pressures between these communities to work. So I would say the changes in trade and this reorienting of trade away from the overland caravan trades, with more and more of the commerce of Damascus coming from across the Mediterranean with European industrial goods, as one of the serious underlying tensions that's changing the social and economic balance of the city.
And of course, Meshaka and other vice consuls and consuls from France, from Germany, from Britain, are of course crowbars who are prying open the Ottoman Empire to allow this. So they've become a focus of anger as well. Would that be, that's...
Absolutely. I mean, I think the whole advent of a consular corps in Damascus, which really only begins in the late 1830s and 1840s, is another very big tension, source of change in the city that creates tension. Because
it's a political and institutional innovation. We don't think of it as that way, but it certainly is.
Absolutely. And there was something specific in the Ottoman context, which is each of these consuls were protected by ancient treaties between their countries and the Ottoman Empire, going back to the 15th and 16th century for countries like Britain and France. Even the Americans and later arrivals had concluded these kind of capitulatory treaties with the Ottoman Empire. But it meant that foreigners and their protégés were given extraterritorial status. That meant they couldn't be tried by local law. If you were an American or an American protege in the Ottoman Empire and you broke the law, you'd be tried by a consular court. You couldn't be taken before an Ottoman judge. And these courts almost invariably decided in favor of their own nationals. So you had a kind of get out of jail card that Christians working for these consular missions enjoyed. They also got trade benefits. They benefited from the tariff advantages conferred by these unequal treaties that the Ottomans had concluded with foreign powers, which meant suddenly, you know, Christian merchants getting protege status through these foreign consulates had a margin over Muslim merchants that just allowed them to get richer at Muslims' expense. The Muslims couldn't compete with them. So the advent of consulates set all sorts of changes in motion because instead of just hiring two or three people as, you know, functionaries in a consulate, these consulates would give protege status to 30, 40, 50 people. And each of those protégés would then be extending their protection or their benefits to their family members. And you'd get hundreds of people claiming protections, many of them quite illegitimately, under these unequal treaties. And for the Muslims of the city in a place like Damascus, where there was a real hierarchy, this just meant that the assertive wealth of these, you know, new Christian merchant elites coming at the expense of their own pockets, there was a constant source of deepening tension.
So, as we've said, Damascus is part of the Ottoman Empire. I believe a humorist once said the Ottoman Empire, an empire so stupid it was named after a couch. This is not necessarily true, especially when we consider Well, as I was saying to you before we began recording, you know, I'm a fairly wide reader, but the Ottoman Empire still, especially in the 19th century, is pretty much a black box to me. I have no idea what's inside. So I was surprised to realize that reform in the Ottoman Empire begins long before the Young Turks, and that in 1860, there is something called Tanzimat, which is a Ottoman reform agenda. And like all our reform agendas, it's leaving people unsettled, especially those, everyone is worried that they might be left out or they might be reformed.
Well, it was change imposed from above, and nobody likes having change shoved down your throat.
And ask any professor.
Ask any professor. Ask anyone for that matter. And I think what made the changes of the Tanzimat particularly hard for the Muslim elites was that some of the changes were designed to advantage minority communities like Christians and Jews in an Ottoman bid to demonstrate to the European powers that the Ottoman Empire protected the human rights of Christians and Jews, and that Britain, France, Germany no longer needed to intervene to protect these minority communities, that they had equal rights before the law. And for you and me, equal rights before the law sounds like a very reasonable direction of reform, but it did mean changes to the legal standing of communities that had been defined in Islamic law and actually were enshrined in the Quran itself. And when the state began to go against things that are in the Quran, which for believing Muslims is the perfect revealed word of God with no human agency, it's almost as though the Sultan and his government were arrogating to themselves the right to contradict God's word. So it provoked a tremendous backlash from conservative Muslims, but also it encouraged an assertiveness, particularly among Ottoman Christians, who now that they had equal rights before the law, began to treat the Muslim communities in their cities, the majority community, with much less respect than had been the norm before. This assertiveness only fed the growing anger and antagonism of local Muslims in Damascus, who had seen their economic interests being set back, who saw Christian communities benefiting from consular privileges in a way they thought was illegitimate. And now the Ottoman state, who should be upholding the interests of the Sunni Muslim majority, are instead creating reforms that are giving these assertive and, dare I say, arrogant Christians even more rights. It was becoming intolerable.
And we should also say, I think you've alluded to this, but I want to make sure this is crystal clear. A lot of these Christians in Mount Lebanon and Damascus have now a certain connection to foreign powers. Reading your book, I was one of my professors, I think it must have been around 1990, 1991. We're doing Byzantine Empire Crusade, something like that. And he was observing how truly odd and shocking it is for anyone who knows anything about French politics that a socialist like François Mitterrand should see himself in 1982 as the defender of the Christians of Lebanon. But that this goes back to the First Crusade. And this goes back to a certain idea of France and the Levant, and its role as an arbiter, and as a protector and defender. Of the Christians there. And that is sort of at issue in 1860. It's actually is not a solution, it's a problem.
It is a very real problem, and one that the Ottomans, through their reforms, were hoping to contain. So the Ottoman government is doing this delicate balancing act of trying to demonstrate its bona fides vis-a-vis the great powers of Europe, while keeping the loyalty of the majority of its Ottoman subjects. And arguably that 1856 reform that gave equality between Muslims and non-Muslims went too far to winning over European public opinion at the expense of Ottoman public opinion. And I would say in that period between 1856 and 1860, you see a growing antagonism. And I guess what really is going to tip it over into something quite murderous is going to be the events in Mount Lebanon, where under very different conditions, antagonisms between the Druze community and the Maronite Christian community leads to a series of massacres in the May, June of 1860. And it's like the Damascene said, we've identified the Christians are a problem. The Druze have identified in Mount Lebanon that Christians are a problem. The Druze seem to have a solution. It's extermination. And suddenly, where Christians had come to be seen as an existential threat, you reach this inflection point where extermination seems a reasonable solution.
So let's talk about the pogroms, not too strong a word, in Mount Lebanon. Third protagonist enters an Algerian exile, Abd al-Qadir, right out of, you could make a movie out of this guy's life and it wouldn't be believable. No one would believe it. But he is an incredible witness, and he is a witness to the complexity of the community of Mount Lebanon. Just to repeat an earlier remark, Mount Lebanon is the highlands of the modern Republic of Lebanon. It is not synonymous with the modern Republic of Lebanon. So what does Abd al-Qadir, first of all, who is he, and what does he see?
Well, as you say, the Emir Abd al-Qadir is one of the most extraordinary figures of the 19th century Arab history. In the book, I refer to him as the most famous Arab in the world. And he certainly was that at the time. He had come to lead the Algerian resistance to the French occupation of their country. The French begin that invasion in 1830, and Abd al-Qadir emerges at the head of it by about 1832. His insurgency against the French goes on a good 15 years, in which he's able to rally a mass of Algerian resistance fighters. He's able to inflict some really heavy defeats on the French. The French are forced to resort to absolute scorched earth tactics to defeat him. And it's only in the late 1840s that they drive him into Morocco, where he is forced to surrender and will spend the next 5 years in French jails before he is pardoned by the new French president after 1848, Louis Napoleon, who will later on become Napoleon III. And in a sense, even by the time he was captured and taken prisoner, Abd al-Qadir had established his position. He was a headline figure in the New York Times then, as he was in the French press. And
we should say that there's a passion in the American press for foreign revolutionaries. And it's interesting to see that everyone compares him in America to Kossuth, the Hungarian revolutionary, who has toured the States and is quite a celebrity for years. And Abd al-Qadir is basically described as a Kossuth of North Africa. And if he had come to the United States, he could have made some good box office receipts. I have absolutely no doubt about it.
He would have been a hit. The other person I've seen him compared to in the New York Times at the time was to the Haitian revolutionary Toussaint Louverture.
Yeah, which is absolutely fascinating. Well, because of the French connection, obviously, both two rebels against French tyranny.
Well, Louis Napoleon decided to give Abd al-Qadir his freedom on condition he never returned to Algeria. That was now in French hands, and they never trusted him to go home to Algeria without being tempted to rise up again against the French. He decided to take his exile in the Ottoman Empire, beginning in Bursa, a city not too far from Istanbul, but then moving to Damascus because as an Arabic speaker, he felt that he would be more at home there. And he arrives in Damascus in 1855 by French frigate to the port of Beirut. And we have a number of accounts of his arrival. He had, even at that time, Europeans keen to write his biographies. One was a British colonel by the name of Churchill, who hosted Abd al-Qadir. And in his biography, actually, I don't know if there's no relation.
I'm not sure. Probably they're all related.
There may well be, actually. I'm not sure whether there was a connection to Winston Churchill there. But among his encounters while crossing Lebanon towards Damascus, he was hosted overnight by the Druze. And I use that as a starting point for imagining what the Druze might have told him about their situation in Mount Lebanon. The Druze being an offshoot of Shi'i Islam, who had taken refuge in the highlands of Lebanon already going back in the 12th and 13th century, and had emerged as a distinct religious community of their own right. They had established a ruling structure of their own that integrated Maronite Christians who were migrating from the north of the mountain range in Lebanon towards the south. And this Maronite Druze hybrid was to survive deep into the 1830s until the turmoil of the Egyptian occupation leads to its overthrow. The Druze were actually not the majority community in the mountain. They, at this point, were now outnumbered by the Christians in Mount Lebanon. And in the aftermath of the Egyptian withdrawal, tensions between the Maronites and the Druze emerged, in which it was clear the Maronites saw the Druze as the weaker party, and the Maronites were keen to drive them out. And the Druze began to see their own position by the mid-1850s as under very real threat, that at the first opportunity, they could find themselves being overwhelmed by their Christian neighbors and driven from their own homes in the southern highlands of Lebanon. So this is the reality that I sort of imagine them sharing with Abdul Qadir in the night that they spend together. The important thing of our story is it's very clear he establishes close ties to the Druze, and this is going to make him a very important intermediary in what unfolds, because it is the Druze that are the driving force in 1860 in launching what are a series of surprise attacks on Christian strongholds in towns like Deir al-Qamar or Hasbeya or Rasheya or Zahle, where knowing that they are the minority, the Druze know they can't afford to lose a single battle. And they use surprise and they use guise to affect what is, in essence, the mass murder of the male population of those towns. They were not keen on exterminating women or children, but any men who would be a fighting age, they wanted to eliminate. And this is an unprecedented bloodletting for the greater Syrian region in 1860. But what it does in Damascus is absolutely electrifying, because the angry and resentful Damascenes have two emotional responses. One is they're quite excited by what they see happening, where the Christians in Mount Lebanon, the arrogant Christians, are finally getting a good thrashing. And so there's no sympathy for the loss of life. If anything, by the time the town of Zahle falls, the Ottomans are having to go into the markets to force Muslim shopkeepers from taking down lanterns they'd raised in celebration. They were so excited by this news. But there's a guilty conscience to that as well. It's not a good thrashing. This is mass murder going on in Lebanon. And there is a fear that there might well be a Christian response to this, in which they might rise up and do violence to Muslims. And so at the same time, you have these wild rumors running through Damascus, reported by Mishaka in his reports back to the consul, saying things are getting very, very tense in Damascus. And I keep finding people coming up to me saying they hear rumors that the Christians in Jerusalem rose up against the Muslims during their Friday prayers and massacred them in the mosque. Or there are rumors of the Christians in Homs to the north of Damascus doing the same thing. And no matter how he tries to tamp down these rumors, he finds more and wilder rumors emerging, until one of his neighbors comes and says, "We hear that in 100 Christian households of Damascus, each is hiding 1,000 fighting men waiting to rise up against the Muslims in Damascus while they're at prayer." So this irrational wave of a fear that the tiny Christian minority community, about 10% of Damascus's population, might actually present an existential threat to the Muslim majority of the city at a time when Christians are being massacred. So you have those two conflicting things, that bloodlust and then the fear of retribution, that seem to have taken the Muslim community of Damascus to the point of, as you say, it's gone from being a pressure cooker. The metaphor now is it's a powder keg and the fuse is lit.
Mm-hmm. So that brings us to 2 p.m., Monday, the 9th of July, 1860. How can we be so precise? It's kind of wonderful to be so precise about an event.
Well, here again, I will credit my main source, Dr. Mishaka, who writes what I believe is the earliest report in Arabic of the events. He writes about 4 days after the events break out. He himself is terribly wounded. And he writes a report to Consul Johnson in Beirut. And in that, he says, you know, at about 8 o'clock in the afternoon, and you have to convert that time to Ottoman time, where dawn is the first hour of the day. There's not a 24-hour clock. And so you have to go back to an almanac and find out what time does the sun rise in July in Damascus, and then add the hours from there. But he is our datekeeper and our timekeeper. And with the help of an almanac, we're able to convert that into a 24-hour clock. So that's how we know at what time the explosion broke out.
There's plenty of violence and destruction and rape and awfulness to go around. Maybe we should focus on what happens at Mashaka's house and take it as a representative of the next 7 days to follow.
Mashaka wrote extensively about his own experiences, but it was gratifying in the American archives to find that there were other documents that had been repatriated that talk about what Mashaka experienced through other eyes. And so we know that one of his consular officials ran in to warn him that an angry mob was building and attacking the Christian quarters. And his first response was to reach out to Amir Abdul Qadir. We've rather let Abdul Qadir drop, but he's important in this story because taking his exile in Damascus, he attracts several of the veterans of his fight against the French, a community that grows to about 1,200 to 1,400 men who were veterans of the Algerian war against the French. And they give him, in essence, a militia that the French consul, who serves as a kind of protector of Abdul Qadir in Damascus, agrees to arm because in the volatility of the summer of 1860, they recognize that the Ottoman authorities were probably not up to preserving safety in the city and that they place their trust in Abdul Qadir and his Algerian fighters. I think that's going to prove to be absolutely decisive in the survival of so many of Damascus's Christian, as we'll get onto in a moment. But when violence breaks out, the first person Mashaka thinks of is Amir Abdul Qadir, and he sends his consular officer to go to the Amir and ask him to bring some soldiers to help secure the American consulate, which is based in Mashaka's house. But before the man is able to reach Abdul Qadir, the mob strikes his street, and Mashaka finds himself barricading himself in the house against the insistent press of the crowd, who are able in very short time to break through his doors. Mashaka takes to a back door. He fills all of his pockets with all the cash he has, hoping that he can play on the greed of the mob by distracting them with fistful of coins. And that's exactly what he does. He takes his family. He is accompanied by a young son, a young daughter, his wife, other members of his household. And they head out the back door, trying through the back alleys to reach Amir Abdul Qadir's house. But at each turn of the lane, they find themselves confronting a new crowd. And Mashaka throws a fist full of coins to try and distract them and run in a new direction. When he's finally hemmed in from all sides, he looks around himself and he recognizes these people. These are his neighbors. It's an extraordinary moment. If you imagine your own street in which people begin to turn against you with murderous intent. And he realizes there's nothing he can do. These people are determined to kill him. His consul officials come to his rescue. They try and fend off the blows, but literally has people striking him with swords. He has people firing at him with flintlocks at very close quarters. The guns were badly calibrated, or the attackers were bad shots, because he wasn't shot, but he was viciously clubbed to the eye, which shut that eye. He took several blows to his right arm, which he raised to try and protect himself. So it was severely cut. He was stripped of his clothes, which were valuable. He was robbed of his money. And he only negotiates his way out by promising the leader of the mob a ransom payment of about 20,000 piastres, which was basically all he had left. But it was a big enough sum to buy him the space to limp away from the murderous mob and try and make his way to the local guards in his neighborhood to try and seek safe haven. But he watches as his little daughter is struck on the head with an axe. She survives. His little son gets away as well. And we have an account from one of the neighbors who reports his wife getting down on her hands and knees to kiss the feet of his attackers, begging for his, you know, for mercy, which is a sign of the desperation and the poignancy of that moment. But, you know, it allows you to go beyond talking about a massacre just in terms of numbers. You begin to imagine what the horror of it must have been like, because the descriptions of that moment in the reports he leaves us are just so intense and immediate. And in that granularity, these reports are like no other document I've ever read on the account.
He might be the foremost scholar in Damascus. He might be the vice consul for the United States. But his experience of violence must have been exactly the same as everyone else for the next 8 days, except they all survive. And that did not. And that was not common.
Yeah.
Obviously, based on the fatalities, the deaths. We should say a little bit more about Abdul Qadir, who is, I don't know if he would enjoy this description, but he's certainly a mensch. And he is, he provides an island of safety and haven in the madness.
So Abdul Qadir is able to mobilize his well-armed force of 1,200 Algerians, and he begins to send them in groups into the crowd to try and get between the crowd and surviving Christians. And he begins to usher them to safe houses. His, in the first instance, the British consulate, which was also spared from attack, as well as the houses of some of the leading Muslim notables who were appalled by the violence that was going on around them to the Christian community, who they saw as an integral part of their city and were in this way determined to help in whatever way they could to rescue Christian survivors. And so in this way, you have this constant ferrying of survivors through the mob by well-armed Algerians who work night and day. And when these safe houses become overwhelmed by numbers, Abdul Qadir negotiates with the Ottoman authorities to take control of the extensive citadel or castle in the heart of Damascus so that they could use that as a safe haven for the Christians placed under Algerian guard. And it was frightening in the extreme for the survivors to go from their safe havens into the citadel. In so many of the places in Mount Lebanon where the Christians were attacked, they took refuge in the citadels of those towns, only later to be handed over to the baying mob and massacred wholesale. But there was no other solution. You were dealing with, you know, 10 to 12,000 Christians who needed a safe haven. And, you know, the houses that they had taken to so far were not large enough to accommodate them. But this process goes on right through Abdul Qadir confronting the crowd, shaming the crowd, reminding them of their duties as Muslims, and then making clear he would not hesitate to fire on the rioters that they got between him and his mission of rescuing the surviving Christians. In this way, I think we can really credit Abdul Qadir. He was credited at the time by all the courts of Europe for playing the most important role in rescuing an estimated 85% of the Christians of Damascus. The fact that that many Christians survived really was due to the intervention of this one man.
Well, there's a lot more to the book, and we're running out of time. So I very briefly, I should ask you, is there any sense that there was a unitary intelligence, a guiding intelligence behind this? Is this just mob violence? It begins from who knows where, and it trails off into no one knows particularly what. Is that sort of the upshot of it? Is this what we learn from this instance and other instances of mob violence? It doesn't require someone to plan it. It just happens like the weather.
Well, it's a question that troubled the Ottomans. And, you know, I would say half of the book tries to answer the question, why do the Muslims massacre the Christians? Which is what people always ask me when I tell them I'm writing a book about an 1860 massacre against Christians. And, you know, for most of our discussion today, we've really focused on What were the triggers that unleashed a massacre? Mm-hmm. In that sense, the book starts rather badly. And, you know, you reach the central chapter of the book and you get 8 days of massacre. But I argue that the second half of the book looks at how you bring a society back from that brink of genocide, of a moment in which people really called for the total extermination of a community. And I think the Damascus events are a really important case study in justice, in the restoration of the property of the victim community, and the reintegration of the Christians after what was a deeply divisive trauma by the, I would say, 25 years after the event. And it was a long-term project. You really could say that the Christians have been reintegrated into their place in the civic life of Damascus.
And briefly, how was that done? I mean, this is, to my mind, the most fascinating part of the book. But how did Ottoman authorities and people like, you know, Abdel Kader and Dr. Mishaka, how did they all work to achieve this?
You know, again, I could go on, but to put it sort of very briefly, the most important starting point is the restoration of law and order. Clearly, an event of mass murder is at heart a total breakdown in law and order. And the Ottomans had to impress on the Muslims of Damascus that the state was back and that those who were guilty would be punished and that respect for the law would be upheld henceforth without exception. And so there is a period in which the Ottoman officials dispatched to resolve the conflict impose very draconian punishments. We have hangings. We have firing squads. So justice and the restoration of law and order, but not perfect justice, because for every execution, you had an event which would raise tensions again between the Muslim community and the Christian community. So you had to put a limit on how far you go there. But that is definitely the starting point. The next is you must indemnify the Christian community for their losses. They lost everything. They literally survived with their clothes on their back, but their houses had been completely plundered and burnt to the ground. The photographs of Damascus, the Christian quarters after the events, look like Dresden. Mm-hmm. After a firebombing. So you have to give people the means to rebuild their homes so they can re-inhabit their quarters. And you have to give them the means to reestablish their professional lives, the tools of their trade, so that they can contribute once again to the economy of the city. But you can't give a total indemnity. There just wasn't the money available in the system to pay everyone back for all of their losses. So just as not total justice, so not total indemnity, but just enough for people to rebuild and restart their economic lives, even if from a more modest starting point than where they had been on the eve of the events in 1860. And then I think you have to invest in the city in a way that brings shared benefits to all communities. And we really see the Ottomans in the mid-1860s, through administrative changes that are part of the reforms, they basically create a super province, cobbling together the provinces of Beirut, of Damascus, and of Jerusalem, which just channels a lot more revenue through the governor of Damascus' hands. Now, he's got to share the benefits with that greater territory, but it meant that he suddenly had the means to invest in the infrastructure of Damascus, in roads, communications, in markets. A massive expansion of the markets that I document goes on here. In the government's presence, which creates lots more government jobs. All this building, of course, creates many more opportunities for contractors, masons, for artisans. So you have a new prosperity in Damascus that brings benefits to all people, and you're expanding the public space, cafes, theaters, in which all Damascenes now gather without them being breaking down along Muslim, Christian, Jewish lines. And in this way, though, I would say that there are crisis moments every time there is another problem between Muslims and Christians in the Ottoman Empire, such as the Cretan revolt against the Ottomans in the 1860s, where Christians in Damascus are once again afraid that they could be back to another massacre or that there's mumblings among the Muslim community. But it never happens because suddenly Everyone is invested in this new future in which the Ottomans are in control. And for those who play by the new rules, there are clear opportunities that bring benefits to Muslim Christians and Jews alike. And I think it's only there where you could see a better future for your kids and for the next generation, that even those traumatized by the events of 1860 are able to turn the page, bury the hatchet, and look to a better future in this new Ottoman order. So to me, that is a kind of new order that follows 1860, that is leading away from the old Ottoman order and towards the new notions of the modern Middle East. And I would say by the time our chief protagonist die in the 1880s, Mishaka himself in 1888, you really could say that he breathed his last knowing that his children and their children faced a better future. What more could you ask for?
I want to briefly conclude by thinking about inflection points. You allude to the fact that your eminent predecessor, Albert Hirani at Oxford, thought of 1860 as an inflection point, but you never got a chance to ask him why. And I'm also, the other thing that was, as I was thinking about this, is that certainly in popular discourse, we often are able to connect the most recent outbreak of violence to a sort of pseudo history of violence. So I could say Syrian civil war. I understand the Syrian civil war. You really have to understand the Damascus events, but that wouldn't help me at all. If I to do that, I have to cut out what happened afterwards, what you just so briefly described. I have to cut out the justice and the reconciliation that preceded the 25 years after the Damascus events. But of course, we do that all the time. We come up with a chain of historical linkages, which is, on close examination, completely sophistical and nonsensical. Most of the chains are made out of those like paper chains we used to make. They tear that as easy as that. So could you reflect on those two things?
But it seems to me that 1860 and its aftermath proves an inflection point in different ways for Syria and for Lebanon. So Hirani, being himself a native of Britain, he was born in Manchester, but his parents came from Marjayou in a village in South Lebanon. You know, he saw, as have all Lebanese historians, 1860 as a defining moment towards the sectarian political order that would define Lebanon down to the present day. Where, you know, the president is a Maronite Christian, the prime minister is Sunni Muslim, and so on through the chain of command. And so for Lebanon, 1860 has that special moment that's quite unique to Lebanon. For the Ottoman world as a whole, you know, I think we see in 1860 and its aftermath an end of an Ottoman order in which, let's say, Christians and Jews were self-governing communities under what is referred to as the millet system. And that order of kind of self-governing minority communities, it gives way to a new notion of citizenship. It starts with equal legal rights in 1856. And in the aftermath of 1860 and this restoration of all, it says, we're not going to accept any challenges to that. That's the reality now. All Ottomans are equal. And that's going to be reinforced by the fact that all communities will have places on all elected boards and local government. You have provincial councils. They have to have Christian and Jewish representatives as well as Muslims. So this new notion of citizenship and breaking with the old millet system is now looking towards a new Middle East of citizens' rights and of participation and even of elected office that has much more to do with the 20th century reality than it did with what preceded it. It's funny because there's slightly different titles for the British and the American editions of the book. For the British edition, they focus on the end of the old Ottoman order. And so it's the end of the millet system. And for the American, it really was the making of the modern Middle East that, you know, this is anticipating what will follow in the 20th century with all of the traumas that includes of world war and of imperialism and the struggle for independence and nationalism. But in a sense, the rule of law and of citizenship, if those are the foundations of the modern age, I think that 1860 is leading the region away from a previous Ottoman order towards a more modern Middle East.
My guest today has been Eugene Rogan. He is the author of The Damascus Events, The 1860 Massacre and the Making of the Middle East. Eugene Rogan, thank you so much for being part of Historically Thinking.
Al Zambon, thank you so much for inviting me.
And thanks so much to you as well for being part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, you can, of course, give us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. But by far the best way of helping us out is to share the podcast with a friend or with many friends. George McDonough is our producer. John Rutta is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambon, and I'll be back with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.